computational physics as a topic to you. I don't want this to be a lecture. I rather want this to be as interactive as possible. I'm going to outline the general topic to you. And if you have questions, feel free to interrupt me at any moment. I want to speak about computational physics. This is about physics and about computing. I don't need to talk about much physics here because there are many people teaching this, but I want to talk about computing. What do you think? What do you think? When were computers invented? Electronic computers were invented in the 50s, but before that, of course, there existed mechanical calculators. But of course, before that, there existed computers who were human beings with the task of computing things. I think they were first around in the 1700s, 1600s, maybe, according to Wikipedia. So if you had something complicated to do, if you have something complicated to calculate today, to type it into Mathematica, in the 1600s, you might be able to hire a computer to do the calculation for you. Now, in the 1600s, high-precision computing, high-precision science and engineering, of course, was not as much around today. But, for example, in astronomy and in navigation, people needed high-precision calculations, for example, to predict when the next solar eclipse happens. And if there was an astronomical institute, there are lots of calculations to do, and I assume there were people hired to just do the calculations, probably with pen and paper, adding and multiplying, long division. But also, you need things like sines and cosines, logarithms, square roots, and people would use tables for that, and some people need to calculate, need to produce the tables. And if you try to find the shortest route from Southampton in England to Halifax in Canada, you need to solve a geodesic equation on a Riemannian manifold, entirely non-trivial. And so that the captain or the navigator can do that, they would have tables also to help determine the position of the ship. So there would be other people calculating the position of the sun and the moon and the planets in the sky so that you can determine the location. And of course, this is calculation. These positions are valid ones. You need to continually update that. So I assume people printed books and the captains bought the books. It is tedious to do so. Now, the way you calculate something depends on what is easy to calculate. So if you, say, want to have a calculation and you have a choice between looking up something in the table twice and then adding some numbers, or looking up something in a table once and then performing a multiplication, then of course it depends on what is faster or what is easier to do. I don't know what is easier, but people then and there, they would have known. And they would have chosen the algorithms correspondingly, depending on what is easy to calculate. These days, computers are electronic, but there are still differences between what is easy to calculate and what not, and the changes on the hardware. And it was different 10 or 20 or 40 years ago, and it is going to change in the future. And thus, how we program computers depends on the hardware, what is available. In this talk, I want to speak about computational physics. I want to briefly describe the hardware that one uses, I mean, not in any detail, but the characteristics of the hardware and maybe how it looked like 20 years ago and maybe how it's going to change in the 5 or 10 years in the future. And then as an example, I also want to speak about how one would solve a partial differential equation on a computer, since that is what I like to do. I'm also a numerical relativist. I like to collide black holes. Yes, I was very excited about the recent experimental discovery. If you want to develop an algorithm that should calculate something, then the naive idea, that is, you take a theoretical model of a computer that was developed by von Neumann half a century ago, and then you take an algorithm and then you describe how it runs on that machine, and then you express it in the language, Fortran or Mathematica or Python, and then you are done. And that works in principle, but it may not work very efficiently. It may be rather slow, depending on what assumptions you make. In practice, thus, you need to know about how computers really look like, not in detail, but there are some high-level things you need to know. And what is a good and efficient algorithm today is very different from what it was 300 years ago, well, obviously, but also what it was 20 years ago. And it's not that people are more clever today and invent better algorithms, but is that the hardware changes, and thus you also need to change as well. So programming a computer is on one hand, of course, we're discovering these abstract truths in mathematics and computer science. But on the other hand, it's also a bit like a race car driver. You want to drive the car efficiently. And if people designed the cars differently 20 years ago than today, then you may also need to adapt your driving skills there. So the von Neumann architecture of a computer, this is how it looks like. Let me get the hockey stick. The control unit, also the CPU, the processor, is the brain of the computer. And this is the memory where you can store some data. This performs the actual calculations. And there's some input-output devices, whatever, keyboard, mouse, screen, printer, or something. And let's assume we want to calculate something, A and B. And the control unit would first read from memory the instructions so that it actually knows that it should calculate A and B. And then it would tell the arithmetic logic unit to read A from memory or from input, then maybe read B from memory, to add them, keep the result in the accumulator, and write the result back to memory or display it on the screen. And this is an abstract model of a computer. And this is how most people still think about how a computer works. And it is certainly how computers look like when I learned computing. But these days, they look a bit different. Here is an image of how a modern processor looks like, all the bits and pieces. And as you see, it's quite a bit more complicated. So let me zoom in at the top. I hope you can read that. Can you read that? So this would be a unit that fetches the instruction. There is a cache. Then there's a 16-byte pre-decode fetch buffer. And then there's an instruction queue. So that means that it's not an instruction is fetched from memory and then executed. Rather, there's a queue or a pipeline of instructions. So if a car is built today, it's not that mechanics get together and build a car. There's, of course, a huge pipeline where something begins. And then hundreds of workers add bits and pieces to the car until the actual car is ready. And you can build a car in just a few hours. And every mechanic works on the car for just a few minutes. And the way a CPU executes an instruction is very much the same thing. There's an instruction queue where the instruction is not yet decoded. Then there are complex and simple instructions that are decoded. It takes a certain amount of time, maybe one, maybe four operations. Then there is another queue of 56 instructions, a reorder buffer of 192 instructions. That is one particular CPU that exists today from Intel. And the reorder buffer, that means the instructions are also reordered. If you program a computer, you may expect it that the instructions are executed in a particular order, but it's not the case. They are executed in a different order. So if you write A times B plus C, of course, you can't arbitrarily change the order because the result would differ. So this reorder buffer also has to take this into account. And let's get to the bottom of the corresponding diagram. And the main reason why things are, why there are so many buffers and why things are recorded and so on, is that that CPU does not have a single arithmetic logic unit, but there are different units. All these green and red pieces here can execute instruction. So this CPU can actually execute up to 10 instructions simultaneously. And if you have a program that is written in a sequential order, do A, then B, then C, then of course you can't take advantage of that. To run at full speed on that CPU, you actually need to feed it something that can be calculated in parallel, that it can do 10 things at the same time. And since the programs that we write these days are still based on the von Neumann architecture, it is the CPU's task to actually find that parallelism. And then it can run something 10 times faster than the programmer intended. And this is one of the big changes that happened in the past 20, 30 years in computing, that these days everything is about parallel execution. And that if you think about things happen sequentially, one step after the other, then you cannot write an efficient algorithm anymore. I want to give a particular example. We recently extended our HPC system here at Perimeter. We bought new nodes that have 28 cores and that can execute 56 threads simultaneously. So this is one computer that can do 56 things at the same time. If you program it in Mathematica, and since Mathematica is not multi-threaded, you ask it to simplify an expression, this will use one core at a time. So in this case, Mathematica can use just a few percent of the total computing power of that particular node. I assume that in the future, Mathematica will become more and more multi-threaded, and there are expressions to do things in parallel. There's parallelize and parallel table and parallel. There's something else parallel. There are many things you can do in parallel. And if you use that, then the particular program could run about 10 times faster on a single node. And if you just count up the various ways, just to get an order of magnitude for a number of how parallel things are, that computer has 28 cores. Each core is superscalar. That means it can execute 10 or 100 different instructions at the same time. These instructions could be vector operators. That is, it would not add one number to another number, but it would simultaneously add four numbers to four other numbers, giving four results. And then also, modern CPUs have a fused multiply-add instructions, where multiplying and adding doesn't count as one instruction. Sorry, not two instructions, but as one instruction, because that is what you use in linear algebra, usually. Linear algebra, you have dot products. It's always multiply something and add it to some result. Thus, this is executed as a single instruction these days. And I'd like to drive that point home. I seem to be quite fond of this point that things are parallel and not serial. So let me try to drive it home a bit. That is an image of a CPU, a picture of a CPU that was designed about 10 years ago. And the CPU may have, I don't know, maybe a billion transistors. And you probably have a million pixels on the screen, so you can't see the individual transistors, obviously. But you still see some kind of patterns that they form. And people have marked here the various parts of the chip and what they're responsible for. Let me mark the ones that we understand in green. This would be the integer execution units. So if you add integer numbers, I want to access an array element or something, that would be integer unit. Here's a floating point execution unit. If you do something in double position in a matrix-matrix multiplication, that would happen there. And the interesting thing is that the CPU is much more complicated. There's about 80% that is not green that does something else. And what this something else does, these red parts here, out of order controls, a scheduler and memory control, these are the parts that allow instructions to be reordered and instructions to be executed in parallel. For example, in the memory control, if you want to read something from memory and you want to read another value from memory, then they may be read in the opposite order, or they may be written in the opposite order. And of course, you can't do that all the time. If you write two values to the same memory location, you better not change the order in which they're written. But if you write to different memory locations, then you may be able to do that in a different order. And roughly speaking, I'd say 20% is green and 80% is red. That means 80% of the CPU is busy just reordering instructions and finding parallelism, and only 20% of the CPU is busy actually doing things. And this chip is designed that way because that's the most efficient way. Because if you write a typical program these days, then these green parts are still actually underused. They're still not running at full capacity because today's programs are mostly serial and not parallel. Now, if you were to write a program that is completely parallel and that could use the CPU, then you don't need the red parts. Then you can leave them out. You add more green parts there. And for the same price, you get a CPU that has about 5 times the computing power. And such chips exist. They're called the GPUs. GPU computing is very in. You probably have a GPU in your laptops as well. They do the graphics processing. And the advantage of them is that they have a lot of computing power. But the disadvantage is that you need to program them in parallel. So if you were to run Mathematica on a GPU, then it would probably run 10 times slower, because Mathematica is not parallel by definition. So if you don't have the red parts finding the parallelisms, then the green parts can't be used efficiently. I notice that most of you are silent, not asking questions. If I'm boring you, talking over your head, feel free to interrupt me and ask questions. I'd like to also present some orders of magnitudes of what kind of performance you can expect from a computer. Now, this is performance in terms of number crunching, not in terms of symbolic calculations for simplification in Mathematica, for example. There is the theoretical peak performance, and there are two numbers that are important these days. One is the number of operations you can perform per second. And a modern processor might be able to perform about 1,000 gigaflop per second. That is about 10 to 12 operations per second. And that is, flop is a floating point operation. Here you see it's targeting number crunching. And the other important characteristic is how fast data can be accessed, how fast data can be read from memory. I think I didn't mention that before, that these days quite a bit slower than actual performing operations. And the typical speed would be something like 100 megabytes per second on a workstation. Laptops are probably a bit slower, I don't know, 10, 20 gigabytes a second that you can read from memory. And if you get the ratio of these, you get kind of the critical number, and this critical number is about 0.1 bytes per flop, and that happens to be the same across many different computing architectures, I mean, independent of who produces the CPU. And the interesting thing is that if you design an algorithm, then you can compare this number for an algorithm to the hardware, and then you can roughly predict the performance of an algorithm. And you can compare different algorithms and see which one should run faster and should run slower. But let's do an example. You want to add two numbers, double precision. A double precision number has 8 bytes. So you need to access 24 bytes in memory. You need to read two numbers, that's 16 bytes. And you write one number, so 24 bytes. And you perform one operation. So that's 24 bytes per one operation. That's 24 bytes per flop. The ideal ratio is about 0.1 byte per flop. So we are off by about two orders of magnitude. So the performance of adding numbers is completely limited by accessing memory. So if you're an efficient code that just adds numbers or matrices or something, you would probably do that at 100 gigabyte per second, but probably only at about 10 gigaflop per second. And about 99% of the computing power is then actually unused. So adding numbers is obviously important, but it's obviously not a good thing to do on today's computers. Yes?
That 100 gigabytes per second memory access, is that for your RAM for your cache?
That is for RAM. Cache is faster. I'm trying to ignore the cache here, but yes. So CPUs don't access the RAM for every operation. They have some kind of local memory around them, actually several layers of local memory. And the CPU has registers, maybe 10 or 100, that can be accessed very quickly. And then there is a certain amount of cache of, say, 100 kilobytes that can be accessed not quite as quickly. There's another level of cache and then the main memory. And the important thing is that you keep values in the cache to make it go faster. We could also think about a multiplication. For example, multiplying to real numbers has the same thing here. But the interesting thing is, let's now think about, say, multiplying complex numbers, if you have a more complex algebra there. And if you multiply to complex numbers, you need to read two complex numbers. So you access altogether 48 bytes, but you perform more operations. A complex multiplication has, what, 4 real multiplications and 3 additions or something, 2 additions, 6 operations. Anyway, it turns out that if you complex multiplication, you have 12 bytes per flop, so you're making use of the computer much better. And if you go to quaternions or spinors or something, other more complicated algebras, it becomes even better. Yes?
The way you've set this out on the slide looks like you're divvying this up according to old school RAM versus, and presumably there's a hard disk that you're not listing there because it's slow. Modern machines tend to use flash memory. How does that change the calculation here for your
performance? Yes. Yeah. I'm using the RAM because these days it's common to keep the results in RAM while you calculate something. And modern machines have solid-state disks that are larger but slower than RAM. Some modern machines also have what is called a burst buffer, that is essentially a solid-state disk that is sitting in between a hard disk that is then a magnetic disk and so on. And I would say it depends on the problem size. If a very large problem size that does not fit in RAM, then this number here goes down even more, the gigabyte per second. And if you have a small calculation that uses only a small fraction of the RAM, say maybe 1 or 0.1%, then it fits in the cache. And then this number here would be larger by a factor of 10.
But if I'm coding something up, is it my job to specify where the computer should keep stuff? Or does the CPU work that out for itself? Or what?
That depends on what kind of CPU you're using. If you use one of the standard CPUs that we have in a workstation, and you use a RAM, then it would automatically put it at the right cache level. But if you want to use GPU computing, for example, they have a thing they call shared memory, which works exactly like a cache, except you have to do it manually. And if you develop algorithms that way, this is the source of a major headache. And you can write a program in Python in one afternoon, and then if you need to do all these things manually, it would take you weeks to figure it out how to do that efficiently. But in the end, it runs 4 times faster. Whether it's worth the effort depends on how long the calculation will take in the end. I mean, if the calculation takes 3 months, 4 times faster is important. If the calculation takes a minute, then no one cares. Yes?
Sorry, did you have a question?
Yes, okay, no. So the point I was trying to do here is that if you just do simple operations, for example, adding or multiplying numbers, then you are in trouble because you cannot use the computing power. You're mostly limited by the time it takes to access memory. But if you have a more complex algebra, for example, complex numbers, then it gets better. If you want to solve the Einstein equations, then, I mean, a complex number is two components. If you store the components that you need for the Einstein equations, you kind of have 50 different components approximately, then it becomes even better. But it's still difficult to make use of all the computing power and not be limited at memory bandwidth. I mentioned that you can calculate the characteristics of a bandwidth, the byte per flop. Oh, this is also called the computational intensity. I should have written it down. And computational intensity is actually flop per byte, no byte per flop. And if you see these things displayed in a graph, then of course people put random things on the axis, so it's always difficult to interpret it. So they might put the algorithm byte per flop on one axis and the CPU performance on another axis. And then if you do it calc right, then the memory bandwidth becomes kind of a diagonal line in the graph. But this is just displaying things in ways that are sometimes confusing for the audience and sometimes make the speaker look more intelligent. I should have put a graph up there. Sorry about that. So if you multiply matrices, this is basically the only algorithm still used today where you can use the full computing power of a computer. Because if you have a matrix, then it has n squared numbers. But to multiply them, you need n cubed operations. So if you make n large enough, you're going to be bound by the computing power and not by the memory access speed. The disadvantage of that is that these days people do not use large matrices anymore. These days people use sparse matrices that have many zeros or have block structured matrices and so on. And did you mention block structured matrices when you discussed tensor networks?
No.
Okay, but you did explain tensor networks? Okay, so if you have a tensor network, then of course you can do all the multiplication out. You get one huge tensor, and this huge tensor would be very large. But there's a much more efficient representation if you can represent it as a tensor network. And then you have only the small tensors that make up the tensor networks. And that is a more efficient way to represent something. But the overall calculation still corresponds to a large tensor. This is one way to hugely reduce the number of operations that you need to multiply two tensors. So in principle, you could multiply out the complete tensor network, and then you get a huge number n cubed. And if you use the smaller blocks, you can be more efficient. I think I made these points already regarding multiplying matrices and adding matrices. A typical architecture of a supercomputer starts with the individual. So supercomputers are the largest computers on the planet that could be used to address a problem. Starts with a chip that contains, in this case here, two processors. You combine them to cards, to inserts, put them into racks in a large computer that has then, in this case, about 100,000 CPUs. And what you notice there is that the supercomputer has mostly many CPUs. It does not have super fast CPUs. So if you run Mathematica on a traditional supercomputer, it would run at about half the speed because Mathematica may use only one CPU, and the CPUs you put in a supercomputer, they need to be energy efficient because it's difficult to cool these things. So actually, Mathematica may be running faster on your laptop than it would be on a CPU in a supercomputer. Now, I'm not trying to bash Mathematica here. I'm thinking about, when I say Mathematica, I mean the symbolic calculations that you do that you're single core. If you're multiplying matrices in Mathematica, then it knows how to use multiple cores, and then it would probably run faster on a supercomputer. So I should not say Mathematica, I should say whatever, symbolic operations that are difficult to parallelize. So I like to show this slide here. When people say supercomputer, then many people think it's like driving a race car, super cool, super fast. But in reality, I mean, it's still very difficult to drive a supercomputer, but it's just a huge thing. It's like an oil tanker. And if you need to transport crude oil from Saudi Arabia to the Gulf of Mexico, then you would not use speedboats or jet planes, although they are much faster than a super tanker. You would actually use a super tanker because that's the efficient way of doing something large. The supercomputers are for large calculations, not for fast calculations. Yes.
Maybe I'm reading too much into your metaphor, but that sounds like you have to think about latency when programming supercomputers.
Oh, yes, you're using all these fancy words that I tried not to use here. But I shall rise to the challenge. So since in supercomputers, you do calculations in parallel, you can do many things in parallel, but that doesn't mean that each of these tasks is actually faster. So if you have a coffee shop, and I like these examples, right? So if you have a coffee shop, and you produce a particular cup of coffee, it may take you a minute to do the nice latte and the nice clover leaf on top and everything. And if you have 10 customers, you can't work faster because it takes that much time. But you can do 10 coffees in parallel if you hire 10 people. But still, each coffee still takes a minute. And the only thing, the trouble you run into is that the people preparing the coffee get into each other's way. So it's probably not actually 10 times as faster, but probably just 5 times as faster. Which also happens in computers. Up until a few years ago, if you wanted to find out who had the fastest computer, there is one list, top 500. This contains a list of the 500 fastest known computers on the planet. I mean, the military and the secret services don't put their computers in there. So this is the year 2015. It's not quite up to date. And this is the power of the computer. Notice that's a log plot here. And these days, we are approximately here. And this is the sum of all the 500 computers, the combined computing power. The yellow line here is the fastest one. And the blue line down here is the slowest computer in the list. So here, the fastest computer, it jumps up every time a government builds a new computer. It makes the new number one. But the other lines are a bit smoother. You also see that if you look at this line, it's basically a perfect exponential growth that you see up here. And here it begins to taper off a bit. So this exponential growth comes from Moore's law. And this tapering off here has people predict that Moore's law has now ended and that supercomputers are not getting faster anymore. No one knows how to build faster supercomputers. And in a few years, the speed increase will change. I personally think if you look at the graph like that, I mean, you're reading too much into that graph, right? There's always a bit of wavy patterns here. Here's a bit higher, lower, higher again. So who knows what that means. And this year, the list comes out every half year. So 5 peaks corresponds to 2 years. That just means that the Chinese build a really fast computer. And the US is, of course, offended by that they don't have the fastest one. So now they're investing money. And I assume that in half a year, in 1 year, will go up again when the US has the fastest supercomputer again, and then everybody's happy again as the computing power goes up. So this list is not that important. Another reason why this list isn't that important is that they actually use essentially matrix multiplication to measure the speed of the computer. And as I mentioned before, I mean, you really need a huge matrix to fill up that computer and make it efficient. And no one is interested in multiplying large, they actually solve a linear system. It's not just matrix multiplication. But no one is interested in solving linearist systems of that size. This is a completely irrelevant benchmark. And people also get annoyed by that. It also takes a long time. It takes several weeks to run that benchmark. So it's solving one linear system, n cubed. So if you increase n to fill the computer, runtime goes up. And there are some computing centers who say they don't want to participate anymore. So people are redesigning the benchmark. And in the future, people are probably going to use different benchmarks. And these different benchmarks are then not geared anymore towards matrix multiplication, towards only using the floating point performance. But they're also going to measure the memory access. And it's going to be something like sparse linear algebra. And these measurements will then be much more relevant for actual re-engineering applications. Yeah, so
question. Yes. The Moore's law, is it mainly concerned with the floating point operations? Or should we expect, for instance, memory access speeds to continue to grow or cache performance?
Moore's law is about the number of transistors on a single chip. And transistors can be continually shrink, and the chips get larger, probably at the same rate, so that you get an exponential out. And the more transistors you can put in a chip, the more powerful the chip, the more floating point operation the chip can do. And what has changed since about somewhere here is that the clock frequencies of chips haven't increased anymore. So when I was little, computers used to be 200 megahertz. And these days they have 2,200 megahertz, 2.2 gigahertz, and that is not increasing anymore for various reasons that are entirely unobvious unless you know about how chips are actually designed. But this is also why computers are getting more parallel, because instead of making them faster, they put more cores in there, and this is why one needs different algorithms. And if you just think about it abstractly, it's not obvious why that would be the case, but the manufacturing and the constraints about how to use silicon and how to dissipate the heat out of the system and how that scales with the clock frequency, that means that it appears to be that between 2 or 3 gigahertz is some kind of limit that people don't want to cross anymore.
So there's no reason to expect that we would run into some kind of boundary
There are many reasons in the other aspects.
You
go back and read the literature,
every 2 years people found a new reason why you couldn't make chips go faster. Things get too small and so on. And the structures these days, for example, they are smaller than the wavelength of the visible light. So people say you can't produce the chips because you have a mask, and then use kind of a photo process to put the mask on the chip, and then you use some kind of acid to remove parts of the chip surface. And once it went below a few hundred nanometers, people say you can't do it optical night, so chips are not going to shrink. These days, there's a 14 nanometer process. People are just being clever with UV light and other processes. And these days, people are saying, oh, but if the structures become even smaller, quantum mechanical processes are going to become more important, and therefore you can't make it smaller. And what happens? I think it's just a question of how many engineers you put at the problem and how expensive it is to produce smaller chips. So it's a question of what people are willing to pay and how long it takes and so on. But I don't think there's a fundamental limit.
But at some point, we reach the atomic size. We can't really have, unless we use some.
Oh, yeah, that sounds like a good argument. But I'm sure you could put several bits into a single atom or something or do something. And of course, if you get into quantum computing where you have a superposition of states, then you can have an exponential increase in the power of computers. Yes?
I think it was a couple of years ago, IBM actually did an experiment to find the smallest object you can have a stable classical memory of.
Cool, yes, what was it?
12 atoms.
12?
Yes.
Okay.
After that, it becomes too unstable to thermal fluctuation.
Okay.
That's your magnetic, usual magnetic.
But maybe we don't need atoms, no? Works.
maybe it makes sense to have computers
cooled with helium. I mean, who knows what happens?
Okay. Now, this was about the parallelism.
Parallelism has another disadvantage when you program a computer. If you have a laptop or a cell phone or a large workstation, then you still have one memory, and the different CPUs, different threads can access the same data structure. You just share the work, but you still work on the same object. But this also has its limit, and these days it seems to be about a few hundred gigabytes. You can't put more memory into a workstation without things becoming highly inefficient. And then you go to distributed computing, where you have independent workstations coupled by a high-speed network. And that is a major headache, because each of the sets of CPUs has its own memory, and that means you need to split your data structures across the computer. So if let's assume you have a humongous symbolic expression that you want to simplify, and then you store bits and pieces of these expressions in different places of the computer, and then you have the CPUs work on bits and pieces of these expressions. And the question is, can you still simplify the expression? Can you still perform operations? Because, I mean, obviously you can't treat things independently. There are connections between them. And how to do that efficiently, that is probably the largest open question these days. But these days, there's a huge rift between parallel computing that you do within a computer. If you have a laptop, when you multiply matrices, Mathematica will happily use all the cores in there. But if you want to spread something around multiple computers, that is very difficult. And it becomes so difficult that most people don't do it. There is a very small fraction of scientists who actually do that in their work. And of course, once you do that, you harvest an incredible amount of computing power. Large supercomputers have 10,000 nodes. That is, in principle, you can run something 10,000 times larger or 10,000 times faster. So imagine a problem that takes 2 weeks on your laptop, and then instead it's done in a minute or something. It's just amazing the problems you can tackle, right? I mean, the largest problem you can tackle in a PhD thesis probably takes 3 months or something. I mean, you don't want to wait longer than 3 months for a result. And if you can instead do that in a day or something, then you could do much more in a PhD thesis. That is, if you were previously limited by computing power, then maybe you're not anymore. But you need to do distributed computing, which is difficult. I'm not saying that everything is limited by computing power, right? In many cases, it's limited by understanding the results, actually. So I want to also speak about the software architecture, which is the programming language, cycling back, that we use to program computers. There are, of course, many programming languages around, and I think every year or something, a new interesting programming language bubbles up to the top, and other ones become less interesting. So that doesn't mean that you need to learn a new language every year. But the new languages that come up kind of share certain features that you maybe not find in older programming languages. And thinking historically, in the 80s or something, programs become so large that it was not possible anymore for a single person to understand the whole program. And then people invented modular programming, where you have a module that has a complex internal state, but externally it has a rather simple interface. And that makes it easy to reuse code from someone else, because you don't have to care about all the details. It's like a mathematical proof that someone has done. All the techniques used for the proof are unimportant if you just want to use the theorem. In the 90s, people began with object-oriented programming, generic programming. For example, in the 80s, if you write a routine that adds to matrices, you say, yeah, matrices, double position number, let's write a routine to add them. And then someone else says, oh, now I have matrices with complex numbers. Sure, let's write a routine for it. And the matrix, maybe you want to store integers, another routine. And then you, at some point, quickly realize, yeah, but you can write a generic routine that adds matrices independent of what type you actually store in the matrices. And this is then generic programming. You need a hierarchy of types. You need an algebra of types. You can also think about that on a higher abstract level. And this was introduced with object-oriented programming. That means you can write more powerful routines, more powerful functions in your program. And in 2000s, obviously, parallel programming became important. Yes?
Are there known examples of famous examples of languages that are based on these different types? Modular programming, what should we think about? Is that Fortran or?
So some languages like Fortran have grown over time. So Fortran 77 is the version of the standard from 77, did not have that. And Fortran 90 does have modules in there. If you think about languages like C or C++, they have some features for modular programming, but the language was never actually updated to actually allow that. But for example, C++ allows object-oriented programming, generic programming, so it kind of subsumes the modular programming as well in a way. If you define a C++ class, you can have private fields that are not visible to the outside. And you may know Mathematica, that has actually not too much of that. So I think Mathematica is lacking in these features. The thing that Mathematica has going for it is the ease of use and beautiful user interface and the large number of libraries that you can simply use. But if you want to write a large, complex program in Mathematica, then you run into serious trouble, because it's very easy to make a mistake here and there, and it's very difficult to prevent that. And you may know Python as well. And Python also has object-oriented programming and modules and so on and so forth. Yes?
Do you know of alternatives to Mathematica that are good with symbolic manipulation and incorporate some of these features?
I'm not aware of anything that could really compete with Mathematica. There's in Python, there's of course SymPy, where you can do something, and it kind of goes in the same direction. But in Mathematica, you have the beautiful pattern matching and so on. And that is very much rudimentary in SymPy. And there is this one project, I forgot the name, but it's essentially an open source clone of Mathematica built on iJupyter, JupyterHub, and Python, and SymPy, and so on, and other packages as well.
I think it's called Sage.
Thank you. Yes, exactly. It's called Sage. And I think this is the best competitor to Mathematica. And I looked into it, and I don't think it's quite there yet, which is why here at Perimeter, everybody uses Mathematica if you want to do something, which is good here because we have a license. But if you have collaborators at other places where they don't have a license, then of course this is bad luck. And when it comes to parallel programming, then I think the question is still very much open. What languages are good and what languages are bad? There are extensions to Fortran, C, C++ for parallel programming.
There's Java, who has a particular idea of parallel programming that doesn't quite scale. In Python, they don't really have multi-threading yet. So there are ideas out there, but I don't think there's a clear winner yet. And another new paradigm that a few years ago I really hoped would take off, but hasn't quite taken off yet, is what is called functional or declarative programming. So instead of saying, I have a variable, modify it by adding something to it, you say, I have two variables, add them and give me a new result. And Mathematica is very much designed in this way. There are very few operations where you actually modify something. You rather get something new out of it. And if you never modify something, then your program looks more like a mathematical proof. Because in a proof, you can essentially look at different bits and pieces, and it doesn't matter in which order you understand and go through the proof. But if you modify something as you go through it, then the order in which something is modified is actually quite important. That made programs more difficult to understand, but on today's hardware, also more efficient, which is why most programming paradigms do not yet use this functional or declarative programming.
Your description there, wouldn't that mean that you need more memory to run such a program?
It depends. If you don't need the old things anymore, then you can throw them out. So you don't need more memory.
There are also compiler transformations where you maybe can change something that the compiler automatically detects something. But the thing is, with parallel programming, you don't know the order in which something happens because there are different threads working on different parts of the program simultaneously. And if that happens, you may not be able to throw something out anyway because some other thread may still need that. So you need more memory for that as well. So I think that has a lot of potential, and I am working on functional programming, making it easier to use for high-performance computing, in particular also distributed environment. You may call it computer science and computational science research, but it remains difficult. I mean, not just getting it correct, but also getting it efficient, because if it works, if it's easy to write programs, but if it's 100 times slower than something else, then people happen to be not so much interested in it.
Would Lisp be an example of this? What language would be an example of
functional programming? Lisp is, again, a mixture. Lisp has much functional things in it, but also things that are not functional. It is common in Lisp to have to add an exclamation mark to the end of the name of the function if it modifies something. So if you use a function like map or add, then no exclamation mark, so everything is fine. And the other language, Julia, that I'm going to be discussing tomorrow, it has also roots in Lisp. So it also has many of these things. It doesn't have multi-threading yet, but it also has this convention that you really see whether you do something that is functional or not. So it gives you the choice. And when I use Julia, I like to use that part that has no exclamation marks, because I think it's easier to write correct programs, but it remains to be seen whether you get the full efficiency out of it or not.
Tried to launch a functional language at some point in the last few years. Maybe they called it F or something like that. I can't remember. Do you know anything about that?
I looked at it. I heard of a language by Microsoft with a name that has something to do with F that is loosely based on a subset of Fortran. And
that is functional. I don't know whether it is the same language, kind of a safe subset of Fortran. So actually, what I heard was not that it was functional, but it was a safe subset of Fortran. Fortran is an old language. You can pass an array to another routine, and you can freely say what size that array has, even if the array doesn't actually have that size. And obviously, things can go very wrong if you have an array 10 elements and say access element number 100. So you can define a safe subset of Fortran where that is not possible anymore, where you sacrifice a bit of performance. And that is important. F-sharp, OK.
So as I mentioned, there are many languages that came out about 5 or 8 years ago.
There was a big initiative by the government in the US to push new languages. And these were languages like Unified Parallel C or X10 or Fortress and so on. And big companies like Sun and IBM and Cray put their name behind these languages and tried to push them in development. Developed them and then got funding from the government. And a few years later, the government funding ended. And they said, well, if it's a language, it should take hold in the community and people should use it. And none of the languages actually survived. There was a big effort to get newer, better computer languages for technical computing. And essentially, they all failed. And some of them, you can still download a snapshot from 3 years ago on some web server and then And others, you find a small booth at a supercomputing conference where some people still say, this is the language, hey, please use me. But in reality, people just use Python or C++. It's a sad thing, right? Because the languages are actually better, but something they got wrong and they were never accepted by the community. I want to mention something about parallel computing as well, and that's a bit more theoretical. Since the advent of modular programming, if you write a program, and if the program is correct, then you can take two bits and pieces of the program that is correct and combine them according to certain rules. For example, if you have write a function, it needs to have certain preconditions that need to be satisfied. And thus, you can write big programs from smaller programs and functions. And that is, of course, group theory, where you have certain elements and you can combine them in certain operations. And that is, of course, the only way we can construct large programs. If you write a large programs in one go, having to understand every piece, every bit and piece of the large program, it would be impossible. First, you don't understand all the things. And second, it's impossible to debug it. One person makes one small change here, and everything else needs to be re-verified. That doesn't work. So modern languages have this property that, I mean, programmers don't call it group theory, but it is clearly group theory, kind of like Lego bricks. And the problem with parallel programming is that there are some ideas, some constructs of the locks, for example, that do not adhere to group theory. So you have a small function written using locks that is correct and another small function also correct, and you combine them in a correct way and you arrive at a big program that is not working anymore. And that somehow is really difficult to deal with. And what people think now, the conclusion at which people have arrived, that using locks, therefore, is not a good idea. The lock is a particular parallel construct. They have come up with other parallel constructs that don't have these properties. There's, for example, one of them is called futures. They're also available in extensions of Python. Another is transactions, transactional memory. And transaction is like something when you go to your ATM and you get money out. And there are two things that need to happen, that the amount of money you have in your account needs to correspond to how much money you actually get from the machine. So it's fine if the machine doesn't give you any money. I mean, that happens all the time. But if it gives you money, the amount of money in the account needs to go down. And if you don't get any money, then better your account remain unchanged. So that's the important thing. Whether the ATM actually gives you money or not is not that important. People can deal with failure. It's inconvenient, but people still trust banks. And that's the idea of transactional programming, that it's OK to fail, but certain invariants, certain guarantees, certain constraints must still be satisfied. And these days, there are CPUs that support transactional programming in hardware and make that more efficient. There is one style of parallel programming that's obviously correct. If you have different bits and pieces that try several transactions at the same time, and even if all of them fail, the program would still be correct technically, because you can't just try the transaction again, but at least the invariant is not violated.
And another
data structure, Jan, I mentioned a future before. A future is a black box that holds a result, but the result has not been calculated. It's something like a pointer to something. And if you try to access the future to get the result out, the thread automatically waits until the result has been calculated. And that also makes it impossible to access something before it has been calculated, so it automatically turns the thread dependencies into something that can be enforced automatically. That's convenient. Okay, and I'd like to give an example of functional programming as well. If you know Mathematica, Mathematica is luckily a very high-level language that has these things as well. So the idea, let me start with the example down here. There are programming languages. This here is taken from Julia, where you can introduce shortcuts, local variables, for example. Let x equals 1 means x has the value 1 in this code block until you get to end. And if you evaluate sine of x, of course, you evaluate sine of 1. But you can use local variables not only for variables, but also functions. You can say let f equals sine, then f is the sine function, and then you calculate f of 1. And down there, f is unknown again. And that is also called functional programming, because you don't make any distinction between data and between functions. I mean, usually you think a matrix, that is the mind of data, and it's fine to pass a matrix around, to store a matrix on disk. and a function, for example, a way to evaluate a tensor network or multiplying two matrices, you'd say, oh, that's a function that needs to be defined at compile time. But no, that's not true. You can pass it around. You can store functions on disk as well. And if you think about that, that leads to programs that have a much cleaner structure, a more high-level approach that makes many things much simpler. And one of the ideas of functional programming that I mentioned earlier is that it allows you to write programs that do not depend anymore on the order in which you have written things. And that means you decouple correctness from the order in which something is executed. And yeah, there's a good tensor network example again. The meaning of a tensor network is independent of the order in which you perform the contractions. It's still important to think about the order, but that means you can change the order freely without changing the meaning of the tensor network. So that would be a prime example for this kind of programming. I think I'm speaking way too much about the computer and physics part and not enough on how to discretize a partial differential equation. So as to not overtax your stomach, I can just drop the second part, because if you're interested in tensor networks, then partial differential equations may not interest you anyway. I'd be happy to talk about that at some other time. But I may just leave out that part and conclude with a slide about Julia, introducing what I want to discuss tomorrow. Julia is a programming language. It's a nice mixture between Python and Mathematica, between C++ and Lisp. And it's a young language that is, who knows whether it will still be around in 5 years. It has enough momentum, it will still be around in 1 or 2 years. And I quite like the language because it has the sweet spot, not necessarily for you, you have to decide that, but for the kind of work that I am interested in, that is high performance computing and parallel programming and so on. And all the features that it has here, it's a high level, high performance languages, a sophisticated compiler, means you get high performance out. The distributed parallel execution, that's the high performance computing that interests me. Numerical accuracy, it has the generic programming, so if there's an eigenvalue routine in Julia, you may be able to call it with double precision numbers, but also with quadruple precision or extended precision, and then you can get eigenvalues to 500 digits if you want, because it's more expensive than getting them to 10 digits. But it's possible, and it's much simpler than doing that in Python or C++. And it also boasts itself with having many packages for many things. For example, eigenvalues, matrix algebra, plotting something, Python interfaces, and so on, that is all supported in the language. And now, fast forward. Main point I was going to make today, that in computational physics, what is a good algorithm depends on the tools that you have at hand. 200 years ago, it would be looking up something in a table and adding and multiplying numbers. These days, electronic computers, but it still depends on what can be efficiently implemented in hardware, and that will in 10 years again be different than it is today. These days, the challenge is all about parallel programming. Don't do something one step after the other, but rather specify things generically that you can do many things, tens of thousands of things, millions of things at the same time, and that are algorithms that can be executed much more efficiently than in sequential programming. Yeah, I guess that's it. Thank you.
If you have questions,
yeah, we have many questions. But if you have any other questions,
you mentioned that you're working on some kind of functional programming stuff for technical computing. I understand.
For high performance computing.
Yeah, can you explain what you?
Yeah, so the big challenge in high performance computing, where I draw the dividing line, is the distributed
memory. That is where you have parts, some threads that cannot directly access things that happen in other parts of the computer because they have a different memory. And you can introduce higher level abstractions for that based on futures. For example, have a future that contains a pointer that points to something remotely. If you access that future, things are automatically copied over to the part where you need it, and so on and so forth. And I think this should very much simplify high performance computing. You still need to think about how things are laid out, but you don't need to manually shuffle things around anymore.
Are you working on the implementation of this?
I have implemented that in C++. And if you look at the back of my head, you see what happened while I did that. And now I'm re-implementing that in Julia. So I now know way too much about the dark corners of C++, of which there are way too many. Okay, thank you.